Gang, are you looking for better sleep and relaxation or relief from pain or anxiety without feeling totally drugged? Well, let me tell you about True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. True Hemp Science promises premium quality, pure ingredients, and true value. They source the highest grade organic hemp from around the world to handcraft the finest full spectrum CBD products in the Austin area and beyond. They offer a complete line of full-spectrum CBD products, including oils, tinctures, skincare lotions, sports rubs, gummies, and chocolates. Gang, I've been using their products for a while now, and they've lowered my anxiety and given me incredibly restful sleep. How Did I Get Here has teamed up with True Hemp Science to bring you a very special offer that benefits all of us. Spend $100 or more at True Hemp Science, and they will include either the number 81 distillate, which is great for nighttime, or the number 23 distillate, which is great for daytime, with your order. And that is a $25 value. Just go to truehempscience.com/HDIGH. That's truehempscience.com/HDIGH. And balance your body and mind with True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. Let's get down. Hey gang, it's Johnny. I just want to take a second to talk to you guys about engagement. Right now, you're listening to the show, and I'm not sure exactly what platform you're listening to it on. But whatever platform you're listening to it on, you can subscribe to it and get an alert every time a new show drops, usually every Tuesday and every Friday. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Whatever platform you're listening on, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, any platform, you can subscribe to it. And if you can leave a comment, leave a star, share it on your social media if it's something that you like, please do that. We encourage you to do that. And also, as far as social media goes, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy on Instagram and Twitter. Give us a follow. Also, you can like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Please do. Anyway, all I want to say is, you like a show, share it, use the hashtag How Did I Get Here Pod. We'll give you a shout out. Thank you so much for listening to the show and engage. Let's get down. Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you did this week. I wanted to say thank you to you guys and give you guys an update about my family out in Florida. I have two aunts and a cousin in Tampa, and they were marked safe. I asked them if they're doing all right. They're like, safe and sound. So I didn't interrogate after that because they're in the middle of a thing. I don't know what the hell they're doing, but at least they're safe and sound. So that's good. And my family in South Florida, all good. You know, it was flooding and stuff down there, but they were fine. Just some rain. No one's house got flooded or anything. And man, am I glad I got out before that hurricane. You know what I mean? All the airports got closed and stuff. I heard the airport got closed on Tuesday. Shit, man, I left on Monday night. Fuck, I would have been stuck there. Well, I mean, you know, it wouldn't have been a hurricane situation, but I would have been stuck there. You know what I mean? Have podcasts and things going on. I got rehearsals. And gang, I want to let you know that tomorrow, Saturday, October 1st, Skyrocket will be playing at Sam's Burger Joint in San Antonio. Always a great time there. That's a great venue, great sound, great lights. We always have a great show there. There's always a great crowd. We have a good time. Our friend Heath Allen will be filling in for our friend Chris Gebbard. So that's always fun. Having Heath is a very animated performer. Very animated. He's over the top, and it's great. It's a lot of fun. It's fun to be on the same side of the stage as him. Come on out to Sam's Burger Joint tomorrow night, Saturday, October 1st in San Antonio for some rock and roll. We start at 9 p.m. We play for a long-ass time, bro. Actually, two sets, and it's fun. All right? So come on out and do that. Gang, I have a great show for you today. A great, great show for you. Yes, man. I have a Canadian-American country music artist, songwriter, producer, multi-genre songwriter. He's landed 10 songs in the top 10 of the Canadian country charts as an artist. His name is Tebe. He's absolutely amazing. He's also a chart-topping multi-genre songwriter who's written songs for artists like One Direction, Flo Rida, Fifth Harmony, Cher, The Veronicas, Rex Gowdy. Yeah, dude, this guy has an amazing story. He started singing in church when he was 5 years old. Okay. Started doing that, started getting his music together, started writing songs, ended up signing with a major label at 15 years old in Nashville. Shit went sideways. He got it back together. He started trying coming back as an artist, and then he realized that he could make it as a songwriter, he thought. So he moved out to Sweden and started writing songs and ended up hooking up with bands like One Direction, Flo Rida, Cher, all of these people, and writing all of these great hits. Then came back and decided that he was going to do it as a country artist again. Released an amazing album called The Good Ones with a lot of praise in 2021. Get out there and check it out. And he's got an upcoming album called Tulum, which he has released some singles for. There's no date for the album yet. Late 2022, early 2023, maybe that's what he said. There's a song, Sync with the Sun, with a great video that's actually shot in Tulum. Beautiful, beautiful video. The single, What Was I Drinking? Great, great song. And I will play Used to Love That Song. Tebe and I have a fantastic conversation about his journey as an artist, as a songwriter. He's a fascinating dude, so smart and so interesting. He's currently on the Shotgun Writer Tour Part 2 with special guest Five Roses. Tonight, Friday, September 30th, he will be in Waterloo, Ontario, if you're listening in Ontario. Tomorrow night, Saturday, October 1st, he'll be in Ottawa, Ontario, and he'll be playing for the rest of the week, all up there in Canada and the Ontario area. So go to tebeofficial.com for all of your Tebe official needs, like seeing the video, this gorgeous Sync with the Sun video, and his tour dates and all that kind of stuff. Fantastic, fantastic conversation. What an interesting, interesting man. Please, without further ado, enjoy my conversation with this fantastic songwriter, singer, and artist, Tebe. Let's get down.
Cover off the old rag top yesterday. Coming through static was a song on the radio. Took me by surprise, hadn't heard it in a while. Tried to turn it down, but had to change the dial.
Before,
still hurts
before,
like
before we get started, we have the same birthday, dude. Different years, but same birthday.
Oh, really?
October 14th, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, that's a good day. That's funny.
Do you have any friends that you share that with?
You know what? Yeah, there was someone growing up in my high school that had the same birthday. That and I believe Usher, the R&B singer.
Really?
I can't say that we're friends. Can't say we're friends, but that's pretty cool.
Wow. Well, I bet you have some pretty amazing friends out there in the music world.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a crazy ride that I've been on. I've been able to make some friends along the way.
Yeah. Well, we'll go through that in just a second. I want to talk a little bit about Tulum, the album that comes out. Does that come out in the fall or in the spring?
It's going to be in the spring.
Okay.
Yeah. We were supposed to have it out in the fall, but I couldn't get it all together, especially with touring in the summer. The summer touring has been insane this year. We're kind of making up for 2 years of no shows, you know? So I wasn't able to make that happen to meet that deadline. So we'll have it out in the spring.
I was looking at the pictures on Instagram, and it looks like people are making up for it energy-wise at those shows, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, it's been great. It's great. You know, I mean, people were cooped up in their homes for the better part of 2 years, so to get out to a show is a big deal for a lot of people, and they're really enjoying it. We start the second leg of the tour, the Shotgun Rider Tour, which is going to take us through Ontario and Quebec in end of September, early October.
And are you in Canada now?
No, I'm in Nashville. I was actually in London, England yesterday, so I'm just getting back.
Right. I remember talking to your publicist about that. How was it?
It was great. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it's really amazing to watch country music grow so much overseas, and particularly in the UK. You know, I know Garth Brooks kind of touched on, Ireland and stuff back in the day where he was selling out massive stadiums and stuff over there. But I mean, it's growing so much in the UK. They just don't have access to it. You know, there's no terrestrial radio over there really for that type of stuff. So it kind of comes down to the streaming platforms and word of mouth. But, I've been making inroads for 4 or 5 years, and hopefully I'll be on the main stage at the C2C Festival, which is the big one at the O2 Arena in London every January or February.
Wow, that's amazing. Is it just country music in general, or do you think that your Canadian connection has something to do with that? Are you
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I've also had a pretty good amount of songwriting success with UK artists, you know, like One Direction and there's a bunch more, but I think that helps bridge the gap quite a bit. It just gives me an extra talking point to kind of make that connection with the people over there in the UK.
Yeah. I know that in the UK, the press always had a pretty strong hand in taste making and stuff like that. Is that still the case in some way over there?
I think everything but country music, sure. You know, country music's kind of its own thing, and I think it's been neglected over there for a long time. You know, especially with the press, just because it was never mainstream. It was never something that was going to sell papers. It was never something that's going to get clicks. So I feel that, you know, as certain artists, big American artists come over, like the Kane Browns and Thomas Rhett and Luke Combs, I think that the press is definitely picking up, you know, what's going on, the movement that's going on over there in the UK.
Right. It's, you know, I remember going over there in the 90s and like to play and seeing like how huge like Bon Jovi was. Like Bon Jovi, like, and in the 90s, like, you know, Bon Jovi couldn't really get arrested in America, you know? I remember how shocking that was, but there is a part of like Americana that they really latch onto.
Yeah. I mean, they love them in general, you know, they do call it Americana. They like that Americana label. Right. You know, obviously there's a lot of, well, I guess what we call like roots artists over here, I guess right. Americana as well, but yeah, I mean, you know, for a long time, country music over there had a stigma, you know, and it was the old school country that people loved. They loved the Dolly Partons and, you know, even like the Brad Paisleys, because what he did was very traditional.
Like, but I mean, Dwight Yoakam or something
changing.
Too.
It's just all changing completely. Right. Yeah. Now that the younger people have access to music over there by country artists that are getting younger and younger, it's just changing everything. It's changing the game completely. You know, what they consider country and what they consider acceptable, really.
As far as being like a guy that's written a lot of pop hits, your choice to go into country music as an artist, was that just something that was happening way before the pop hits and everything?
Oh yeah. Way before. Okay. I mean, I grew up in Canada and, you know, people don't really think of country music when they think of Canada straight away. But I don't know. I mean, I've always kind of been against the grain. I mean, my dad's from Nigeria in West Africa and, you know, he came over to the States to go to university and he discovered acts like Charlie Pride, and, you know, and George Strait and stuff like that. So, yeah. You know, he's a guy that you wouldn't expect to love country music, but he did. And he passed it down to me. So, I mean, it's always been, country's always been a big part of who I am. You know, I may not look the quintessential part of what a country singer should be, but, you know, being able to break down some barriers has been pretty awesome. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the music speaks for itself. You know, I put our stuff right up there against some of the best that that Nashville has to offer. And I think that's why we're having success.
Are you based in Canada now?
No. I've been in Nashville probably 15 years.
Okay.
I mean, I first moved to Nashville when I was 16. Cause I had a record deal with, MCA Records. I mean, it was more of I guess what they would call a development deal at the time.
Yeah.
I've been here a really long time. I moved back to Canada for a couple of years in early 2000 and I met my wife and then we came back down.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Canada. When you were a kid, you started singing in churches. What kind of church?
Yeah. Just grew up singing in church.
What denomination was
eventually
that?
Eventually kind of made my way into local singing competitions. And then there was a contest called the Canadian Open Country Singing Contest. And it was in a small town called Simcoe, Ontario.
Okay.
And I ended up winning that. There's different age categories, right? I think I won like the 14 and under category or whatever it was. And part of that prize package I was able to record some demos. And, you know, I was a kid, I didn't really know any better. So I pretty much just dropped a bunch of these, CDs in the mail and sent them off to record companies in Nashville. And, sure enough, out of the blue, I get a call from a lady named Rhonda Johnston, who was the executive assistant to Tony Brown at MCA Records in Nashville.
Legendary, you know, legendary label guy. Tony
Oh,
Brown.
Yeah. I mean, Tony's,
yeah.
you know,
yeah, yeah.
worked with George Strait. Yeah. And, I mean, just endless discography there. But yeah, I worked, you know, they flew me down to Nashville. I went in and sang for them. I mean, I'm 15 years old at this point.
What?
Went in and sang for them.
Real quick.
They offered me a development deal.
Hang on a second.
What was that?
Because you're only 15 years old at this point. That's a lot, yeah. man. You know? Like, that's a lot for a 15-year-old kid. Like, where were you at? Like, were you were at school? What grade were you in?
Man, I was probably 10th, maybe 9th grade. 9th grade, I believe. Maybe 10th.
So there's also, like, a level of work that comes along with all of this stuff that's way beyond, like, what a high school kid actually thinks. I mean, I had bands in high school, but, like, I didn't have, like, a record deal or anything like that. And I could just imagine, like, by the time I did, it was such a – I would have exploded in some way. How did you handle that?
I mean, I definitely had my moments where I acted out, you know, of course. But I've always been very focused, if I'm honest with you. I've always known what I wanted to do, and this was I just got started a little early. They were very smart, you know.
Real quick. I'm sorry. How did you know this was what you wanted to do? Like, what was it? What was it that do you remember, or you just always have wanted to do this?
No, I don't really know when. There was no specific age or situation that happened that kind of, you know, was like, okay, now I want to be in the music business. It was never that. I think it's no different than any other kid growing up who wants to be a hockey player or a football star. You know what I mean? Like, you just kind of know. You know, there's something inside of you that says this is what I was meant to do.
Yeah,
I think I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah,
let's work hard and see what happens.
Yeah. Okay, so all right, so I'm sorry to take you out of the place, but so you go to Nashville, you're 15. And what were they having you do? Write with people?
Yeah, basically, it was a lot of that. It was a lot of writing with people, just kind of learning about the business in general, going out to watch showcases, doing some media training, stuff like that, playing songwriter rounds. You know, we do that in Nashville quite a bit. So it was really just anything just to give me experience and just to kind of see if I could handle what they were going to throw at me. You know, to continue the story, I did that for about 2 years, and then the deal was up and I was offered a full record deal, by MCA. But at that point I'd been around town for a minute. I mean, my dad, just to back up a little bit, my dad moved to Nashville with me, and my brother and my sister and my mom stayed back home in Canada. So, obviously I had to have that support system, but, so after a couple of years of doing that development deal with MCA, I was able to get into what we call in Nashville a bidding war. You know, there was two other labels, one of those being BMG, which is now Sony, and then DreamWorks Records. So there's these three labels that that wanted to do a deal, and I ended up going with BMG.
Awesome. What year was that?
Ooh, 2001, if I had to guess.
So there was still money. Maybe was it a 360 deal, or was it before 360? Because that kind of turned and became 360 became the norm around that time, a little bit after.
Yeah,
that,
no, there was no 360. I think they were kind of just on the cusp of that. That might have been a few years away. I'm not sure.
Congratulations.
But, it led to a publishing deal, which is great. You know, I mean, imagine being a 17-year-old kid who's got a publishing deal. I was signed to Warner Chappell Music simply off the back that I had having a record deal.
Right.
It was a lot. It was a lot to take in as a 17-year-old.
Yeah. I was also signed to Warner Chappell on the basis of having a record deal as well. When they signed you, they didn't really send you out to write with other people for other people. It was to make your record happen. Because that's kind of the way that I was approached. I thought that I was going to get to go write with a shitload of people. And they were like, no, motherfucker, you better have some hits for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it was. Go out and write your record. We're going to put you with the best that we got.
Right.
And figure out who you are really quick. And we're going to go have 10 songs on that album. But I mean, I've always been very conscious about the opportunities that can happen if you're able to write hit songs for other people as well. You know, I wasn't narrow. My focus wasn't super narrow.
Right.
I'm trying to say. I loved writing songs just in general, whether or not it worked for me or for someone else. And that's kind of still the way I am to this day.
When did you start doing that? Like, when did you start writing songs?
Probably around 12.
Wow. That's early.
Yeah, probably around 12. I feel like my learning curve was pretty fast just because I was thrown to the wolves. I had to go in pretty quick and figure shit out.
So when you were 17 and you're going in and riding with these people, were you intimidated? Did you know what you wanted? Were you able to be like, no, bro, this isn't gonna fly with me?
A little bit. I mean, you know, having a record deal, being signed to a major label before you're even 18 and having a publishing deal and making six figures a year. I mean, there's a certain amount of cockiness that's going to come with that, of course.
It's
like anything. So I feel like it was trying to balance out what I thought I knew and what I needed to learn, because they put me in the room with some of the best that they had at One Chapel. I mean, even on Music Row in general. So there's a lot of times where I tried to insert my ego probably into some of these sessions as a kid, when I really shouldn't have, and I should have been learning a bit more.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you got through it, right? I mean, you seem like a really nice, well-adjusted person while I'm talking to you. And that's a great thing to see, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of that comes down to just being with my wife since I was 20 years old.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we've been together a really, really long time. So yeah, I think that helps. That helped me with my transition out of losing that record deal and then eventually making my way back to where I'm at right now.
So the record came out and it just didn't happen?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's also probably worth noting that my first record was produced by two different people. Half of it was Byron Gallimore. I'm sure you know who Byron
I know
who is.
I don't.
And then Bob Rock, of all people,
fuck yeah, I
did
know
the
Bob
other
Rock.
Half of my record.
Yeah, I actually know. I was signed to Lars Ulrich's label.
Cool.
When I got that Warner Chapel thing, and I ended up working a couple days with Bob Rock out in San Francisco. He's a nice guy, man.
He's great. We had the same manager, a guy named Bruce Allen, up in Vancouver. You know, he manages Brian Adams and Michael Bublé, a bunch of people, if you don't know. And then he manages Bob as well. So that's kind of how that whole thing came together. I mean, Bruce is really, really smart. He's a smart guy. And he said, you know, I've got this artist who's obviously different. Let's try to put him with someone else who's different. And that was Bob Rock. That was his first ever country album that he made.
That's amazing. That is an odd choice for something like that. Let me ask you this, because you were different, and I know that the South is always the South, even no matter how cool it can be. How did that affect you, like your cultural differentness, both being Canadian and African American or African Canadian?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that it had some impact on it. I mean, I was a kid, so I don't think I was really even aware of that. Honestly, I mean, I grew up in Canada, which is very multicultural.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that racism didn't play a part in my life at all, but it really didn't. You know, I think we're kind of, you know, we're lucky growing up in Canada because we're kind of shielded from a lot of that stuff. So I didn't really feel that I was different or doing or would be given the opportunity just because I happen to be a half black kid. Okay. But looking back now, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. I was just ahead of my time. I was way ahead of my time, and I think Nashville just wasn't ready for having a person of color, other than Charlie Pride, obviously. And they had to hide his face for how many years, right?
I was born in like 1968, and I remember in the 70s seeing him and hearing that kind of music coming from a guy like that was like, oh, how did that guy, what's going on? Why are you doing that? You know what I mean? Like, why are you
well,
jamming with those guys?
The difference between me and him is he's from Mississippi,
right, I think. Yeah. Anyway, I just wondered if that did play a part. I've talked to some people on here, like, you know, people of color that have had to deal with the big business of Nashville. And a lot of times there can be like tokenism, which is like there's this like push to do it. Like, hey, look, we got a black guy. You know what I mean? And then there's also like, you know, you can only get so far. There's like a glass ceiling, so to speak, on some level with some people.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, the only thing I ever really heard, and I wasn't even supposed to know this, it came through my management, Bruce Allen, who had spoken with Joe Galante, who was the president at the time. a New York guy, right? So a New York guy as well, not a Southern guy who's running this Nashville label.
Okay.
And I remember, what did he say? He said, he talked to a program director in Texas and he basically said along the lines, and I'm paraphrasing right now, but, I don't think my audience is going to relate to him. So, you know, I think that was the most direct that they ever got, about what I looked like and how apparently that would influence people's view of the music when it shouldn't have. But again, you know, I'm content with what happened and the way it all went down. I mean, I feel that I was just ahead of my time and I'm proud to watch these other artists kind of succeeding today. I mean, including myself, I guess.
How did that do with that, with your young ego then having this like slam on the brakes on this cool ass career you having?
Man, I don't know. I don't really know, to be honest with you. I remember not freaking out for whatever reason. I didn't freak out when I ended up losing my record deal. I was young. I felt like I had the whole, you know, my whole life ahead of me. So I didn't freak out. But as things, you know, as the time went past, 3 or 4 years where I didn't get another record deal, and I kind of transitioned at that point into writing songs for other people, which is what I figured I would do anyways, because from day one, even when I had a record deal, as I said, I was still writing songs with the hopes that I would get on Tim McGraw's album.
Right.
So I don't think I was really as devastated as I thought I might be, if I'm honest.
Yeah. So you kept your deal with Warner Chappell at that time, or did you lose that as well during that time?
That stayed on for about a year after.
And is that how you got into
writing?
I'm still in
Nashville, still writing songs. Okay. And I actually remember I went up to New York and I met with Clive Davis because even
Holy
Joe
shit.
Galante, he wasn't, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, man.
You know, 'cause I think Joe Galante, just being a New Yorker and what he saw in me, he wasn't sure if I actually knew who I was, to be honest, as an artist. So I think he was like, okay, go meet with Clive. Let's see if there's something for you there still within the company. And then, yeah, so I went up and did that and then it didn't really work out. And I just kind of moved back to Canada, maybe around 2004.
And okay. So how did you meet your wife?
I met her, believe it or not, in a bar. There's a guy named Sean Desmond, who is still one of my best friends to this day. Like, Sean was in my wedding and he was the biggest domestic pop star in Canada for many years. I mean, from the age of 18 to like 28, 29, he was a pop star.
Okay.
Up there. And when I moved back to Canada, I changed my management. We ended up having the same manager and I got in the room with him and started writing a bunch of songs. And, nah, I totally forgot where I was going with that. What did you ask me? I totally forgot. I went off on a tangent.
How you met her?
Oh yeah. Anyways, and then one night I was out after one of Sean's shows. He had played a show in Toronto, and we went out to the club after. I mean, we're 20 years old, right? And he's famous. We got security around us. We're living the life. And I ended up meeting my wife at a club that night, or a bar club. Yeah,
that's awesome, man. Been together ever since. Do you guys have kids?
We do. Yeah. Our daughter turns 10 in a couple days. And then our son River is 7.
Wow. How did you guys all do during the pandemic?
Pretty good. You know what? We actually went to South Africa.
Really?
Yeah, we had a trip planned for a long time to go down there. We actually took our daughter when she was 8 months old. And then we fell in love with it. I mean, Cape Town in particular is fantastic. So we wanted to take her back. And then our son as well, about 10 years later. So we did, we had this trip planned. And we kind of thought that COVID would be over by then. We're talking, you know, this is 8 months prior. And we ended up going, this past year over Christmas, to South Africa. And, so we spent a good chunk of time down there. We were supposed to go for 3.5 weeks and we ended up staying 6. Simply because Virgin Atlantic canceled our flights to come home because, you know, that you have to fly through the UK.
Right.
And the UK had stopped all flights coming in because that new variant, whatever that was.
Right.
So we just kind of got stuck there, but it was great. We spent a lot of time in South Africa.
That's awesome. That's it. You don't hear many of those stories. Some people are like, no, I was at home freaking out. Like, I didn't know what to do. I was singing to my phone.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I've always just said that it is what it is. And I wasn't going to stop living my life because of this. And everyone thought we were crazy. You know, we went there for, you know, almost 2 months and nobody got COVID. So we were really lucky with that.
Good. Good. All right, so let's go back. So you're 20. You're hanging out in Canada, and then how did you start writing with other people? What was that transition?
You know, again, it was the Sean Desmond thing. It was right working with Sean on his album, and then I had had a couple hits with him in Canada and Germany, I guess, and eventually. I started working on like Canadian Idol. You know, I've always been a hustler, right? Like I learned very early on that no one's going to do it for you. You got to do it for yourself. Even if you have a publishing deal. I mean, ultimately publishing deals are like a bank loan with horrendous interest, right? We all know this.
Yeah.
I just started writing for Canadian Idol and had a couple number ones in Canada, a couple winter songs, you know, and then I got a call out of the blue from my buddy, John Rich.
Wait, real quick. Didn't you worked with the Rex Gowdy guy?
Oh, Rex Gowdy. Yeah. I wrote a song for him called Run that went number one. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm no relation to that guy, but he messed up my Google stuff for like 10 years. Like, you know, every time you're Googling. Go ahead. So, yeah.
I did work with Rex. That's hilarious.
So you worked with Canadian Idol?
Yeah. Canadian Idol. There's a little bit of a delay. So if I talk over you, I apologize.
No problem.
So I did that. I got a call from my buddy, John Rich from Big and Rich. Out of the blue. We kind of came up together, me, him, and Big Kenny, and Cowboy Troy as well, in Nashville. We were hanging out. I was a lot younger than them, but we always just hung out. And they did that Music Mafia thing. So I would always do that with them. And I had written a bunch of songs with John and Kenny. And I got a call from John saying, hey, man, we just cut this song that we wrote. You know, do you want to come down and sing some background vocals? And I'm like, yeah, man, let's do it. So I did. And I ended up getting a new publishing deal off the back of that with a company called Olay. A Canadian publisher, who obviously had offices in Nashville, and now they're called Anthem. But I signed a deal with them and moved back to Nashville.
That's awesome. And so how did you make the transition like into the pop world? Was that through Olay or?
No, not at all. Again, going back to what I just said, you know, I just hustle. I had my eye on the prize, and I figured out very early on that a lot of American pop music was being made in Sweden. Uh-huh. So I literally just started going to Sweden. I met a couple Swedish writers at one of the Canadian Idol songwriting camps. Uh-huh. Up in Toronto, and became friends with them, and ended up just hopping on a plane and going to Sweden. And you know, from there, I you know, not that I was like trying to climb up the ladder, but ultimately I just met people in the Swedish music industry that were higher and higher up the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And, you know, even to this day, a lot of my friends, were working with Max Martin and had gone on to have massive, massive international pop hits. So I was just, yeah, I just realized what I needed to do. And I just kept going back to Sweden. And, I remember, my contact at Olay was a guy named Gilles Godard, who's Canadian, but he's actually the president of Anthem now. He just got promoted to becoming the president. Still one of my dearest friends. And he remembers getting so much heck for sending me over there and spending, you know, $3,000 for me to go and write for a couple of weeks in Sweden. Robert Ott, the president of Olay at the time, just wasn't feeling it. He didn't understand how this Canadian country singer kid going to Sweden would pay off.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually it did. Two songs on an album by One Direction that sold 12 million copies. I mean, you can imagine the mechanicals on that.
It's phenomenal, man. I loved that band too. I did. Like I dug their whole trip. I even went to go see that Morgan Spurlock movie by myself one afternoon. It was just all these moms and their kids. And like I was by myself, like just sitting there eating popcorn. That they were great. And I'm a huge Harry Styles fan.
Yeah. I mean, this was the second album. So this was like kind of the peak of their album sales. You know, this is the one that really, you know, nothing to do with me, but this is the one that really broke them into the stratosphere of being superstars. And I just happened to kind of get lucky. You know, I was going over there and I wrote at the time, my buddy, Carl Falk had written the first, That's What Makes You Beautiful. That's What Makes You Beautiful. Like their debut, massive monster smash.
Yeah.
And again, Carl's one of those guys that I've been hanging out with for 5 or 6 years in Sweden.
Right.
And eventually one of my songs that I wrote here in Nashville with a guy named Tommy Lee James, who has written countless number one songs in Nashville. We wrote that song here, and it found its way to their A&R at Psycho, which is Simon Cowell's label. You probably already know all this, so I'm not trying to be demeaning.
No. There's an audience listening. Yeah.
Yeah. Found its way to Psycho. And next thing you know, I'm on a plane to London with my buddy Julian Benetta, who, I'd also come up with in the business. He was out in California, and he was friends with John Rich. So there's a lot of these people. We kind of just came up together because we're the same age. And then I got to work with the boys and ended up getting two songs on there. And, you know, I'm listed as vocal producer because I was in the studio with them. And it's been a crazy ride.
Yeah, that is a crazy ride, man. And from then on, so when did you all of a sudden decide, did you decide you wanted to do an artist career again? Or did people come to you and be like, hey, man?
I just kind of got the itch again. I mean, what really did it for me was there's a band called Emerson Drive.
Yeah.
And they were having a lot of success in Nashville, you know, like ACM award nominations and stuff. And, I had their Canadian band, but they were in Nashville. So, I mean, once you meet one Canadian down here, you kind of meet them all, you know,
run
in the same circles. So I ended up befriending those guys and I would write some songs for them. And then they took me out on the road. So I would go out on the road with them and just hang out, really just hang out and maybe write a couple songs while we're there. And I used to see them getting up at these festivals and fairs and singing the songs that I wrote. And I'm literally like, shit, I can do that. Like, I think I sing pretty damn good. Let's go. And I did it. And then we just started having success. And it's been a slow and gradual type of grind. I knew that I didn't really have the desire to try to break it in America, just because at that point my wife and I were thinking about having kids, and I know how hard it is and how much you have to be gone to really try to give it a go in America. And I just didn't really have that desire. So I mean, my focus has always been trying to be a big fish in a smaller pond, which is Canada. And that's kind of where we're at right now, depending on who you ask.
Well, I mean, you totally are. I mean, if you look at your numbers, the accolades, I mean, you are an extremely successful songwriter and artist. And I bet this has been a really great pleasure getting to talk to you. And we're not done yet, but I really like you. And I really, that kind of hustle thing, whoever's listening, that's like, you know, a lot of musicians and stuff, listen to this. Doing all, like, going out and like, if you sit at your house and wonder why nothing's happening with your great music, it's like the chances of someone just coming across your shit on SoundCloud is so slim. You know what I mean? It's still about going out and meeting people, you know, and not being scared.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially when you're younger, you know, when I was in my early 20s, it wasn't that daunting of a task. I've just always had that hustle mentality in my soul, you know. And we can talk about when that was kind of broken, which was only a couple of years ago, because I think that's going to be an interesting thing for people to hear about. But no, I just knew that I had to do it for myself. No one was going to do it for me. So I've just always been traveling. I mean, going overseas was the first real step of doing that, just kind of be like, okay, I know all these massive pop songs are being written by this dude named Max Martin. Right. He's in Stockholm. These are his other people that he works with. Yeah. How the hell am I going to get in the room with these people?
Yeah.
And it's all about hustle. And I figured out how to do it. It took me a couple of years, but I eventually figured out how to do it. I learned their language. That's another thing too. It's like, I speak fantastic Swedish because I learned their fucking language.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did what you had to do. So tell me about what happened when it got broken.
Man, you know, back in 2017 or 2018, I finally got my number one song in America. I finally had a Billboard country number one after 10 years. And it was Justin Moore, Somebody Else Will. And it was the best time of my life. And it was the worst time of my life professionally, simply because, you know, you work your whole life to have a number one song in the States. I mean, that's the pinnacle. It's hard to beat that. And I did it. And I literally felt like nobody gave a shit, including BMI, including my publisher, BMG. And again, I have no issues calling them out because I kind of just don't care. I'm very straightforward. I'm a straight shooter. It was as if nobody cared in that office that I'd worked my whole life to have a number one. You know, in Nashville, I don't know if you know this, but in Nashville, every time someone has a number one song, BMI or ASCAP, the PRO, will throw like a little party. People get up, they talk about the song, they give you a really cool plaque, you have some hors d'oeuvres, and then you're done. I never got one of those. I never got one. And that really bothered me. And it wasn't an ego thing. It was more just like, okay, I've worked my ass off. Why can't you guys see that? Why does everyone else get a party? And not me? You know, I always say, like, I'm not Ashley Gorley. I haven't had 60 number ones and have once every other one every other week. This was a big deal for me. And they never threw a party. They never, BMG, they never put up one of those. Well, they did eventually put up one of those banners. I don't know if you spent much time in Nashville, but on Music Row, they got those banners that says BMG congratulates or okay. Warner congratulates the songwriter.
Yeah.
Because it's all about the songwriter in Nashville. You know, we don't get celebrated as much as I think we should.
Right.
So it took them months to put up a banner. And it was just absolutely soul crushing. Nothing really changed for me professionally. I wasn't really getting any bigger co-writes. None of that really came to fruition. And I truly believe it was just for whatever reason, you know, my publisher didn't really kind of care too much. And I don't know if that had anything to do with me being sorry, go ahead. What?
No, that sucks. Sorry, that sucks. You don't know if it had anything to do with you what? Sorry.
Me being signed at the LA office, because when I did the deal with BMG, it was right off the back of the One Direction and, you know, the single of the year Brit Awards and stuff like that. So I, you know, I built myself up as a pop songwriter. And then I did a deal with BMG. Zach Katz out in LA is the one that signed me, even though I was living in Nashville. So I was kind of like, I kind of got passed on to the Nashville office because my deal was out of LA. And I really thought things would change in the way that they viewed me as a writer once I had a number one, but it didn't. So when that whole thing went down, I spent like 6 months trying to get out of my publishing deal because I was just fed up at that point. And eventually they let me out of my deal. And then I kind of just fell into like a really bad depression. I've always struggled with mental health, and I've been very open about that because I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, mental health and depression doesn't discriminate based on your race, your tax bracket, none of that shit. So I've always been really open about that.
In what?
I fell into a really deep depression. I just didn't even write songs for 2 years. So there was not really much opportunity to capitalize on the success that I had. You know, I can't blame it solely on a publisher or not having a party, but I think that had a lot to do with it.
Were your mental health issues before also depression oriented?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always been that. I mean, even to this day, I struggle really hard. There's really bad days, but you know, the older I get, the more I'm able to keep it under control.
What do you do?
Yeah, so that kind of,
what do you do to keep it under control?
Ahead. Ooh, it's hard. It's really, really hard. My wife and my family have been a huge support system. Absolutely huge. My wife, I mean, she's still with me to this day, even though she probably shouldn't be, you know? So she really helps me, obviously being on the right medication, talking about it, going to therapy, all that stuff that they say helps. It really, really does.
Yeah. The one thing about those things is like the therapy and all of that stuff doesn't work unless you actually are ready for it to. That's always the thing that I find, like when people get sent to therapy or like they're depressed and they go in, but they don't actually realize the work involved. Like you don't walk in and like go to 3 sessions and you're fine. It's like a thing where you have to start digging in. It turns into this whole like job that costs you a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The thing with mental health issues, right, is like you can't see it per se. It's not the same as being an alcoholic or you know, someone
exactly right.
who does heroin all day long. Yeah. You know, it's hard for people to see. So I think for the longest time, because I can be fine. You know, I'm completely fine right now, but tomorrow I may get an email that really pisses me off and I'll be in bed for 2 days. Yeah. You know, it's just one of those things. But no, you're right, 100%. It's just like going to rehab. You got to put the work in.
Yeah.
It's not something that's just gonna happen because you read a book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So how you're feeling? All right. You're feeling better now. As you get older, it kind of goes away, but you're... in a better place.
Yeah, I still struggle. But I mean, I think the resentment that I had for that time in my life, after the number one, I think that's a lot of it's gone now. It just is what it is. You know, time heals all wounds for the most part. And I believe that. And it took me a long time to get over that. It really, really did. I feel like I lost 3 or 4 years of my career simply because I couldn't deal with what I was facing. That's when my artist career kind of took a different path, because I was like, or my career in general, because I stopped writing songs really for cuts. And still to this day, I don't really write songs for cuts. You know, the business is it's become very LA in Nashville in the sense that it's very political. You have to be signed to a certain management company because they manage Luke Bryan. Well, they're going to give you access. You know, even with the number one that I had, the Justin Moore thing, two of my co-writers were published and still are published by Justin Moore's producer.
Okay.
So that's, you know, and I didn't mean to play those politics, but that's just kind of how it worked out. And that's maybe the only reason why we were able to get that song in front of the artist.
Right. Well, I mean, at least you did. Are you, this is a weird question, but are you still with BMI?
Yeah.
Okay.
for the States, and it's just for simplicity purposes. Basically, I had become pretty tight with SoCan up in Canada, and I was ready to leave BMI almost instantly, but I couldn't because of their deals. The way they structure their deals is actually very smart. You only have a very small window, right?
Yeah.
To get out, it's very smart on their behalf. But to be honest with you, SoCan just threw a lot of money at me. They paid me. Basically what I had made to have a number one record to come back to SoCan, for the world, which I did probably 3 or 4 years ago now, or maybe 3 years. And then BMI they still collect for me in the States. Yeah. They do. Yeah.
All right. So I've been an ASCAP guy for forever, and there's a BMI guy that I've become friends with. He's like, come on, man, just move the stuff over here. And the same thing with ASCAP, you only have a window. And so there's a window coming up in the new year that I have to decide. And when you just told me that story, outside of feeling bad for you, I was like, well, they're not going to throw a party for you when you have a number one record, then why am I going to move over there? Yeah.
I mean, you know, I can't blame an entire corporation for the actions of a couple people, but it did suck. But, you know, again, water under the bridge, I've moved on. I think at some point, you know, you better be, you know, you can be sure that if I have a massive hit again in the States, I'm not going to be letting BMI collect that money for me.
Yeah. Are you, so when you're doing this tour, the Shotgun Rider part two, you're doing Canada mostly or all, except for what you did in London. How big is your band? Is it like five people?
I've got a 4-piece band, but I carry a lot of crew. Just because I've never, so basically, to be honest with you, I invest a lot of my songwriting dollars back into my artist career up in Canada. I have a full band and crew. We took a semi truck out last time of lights and production.
Yeah, baby.
Even though I'm not playing, even cut arenas, I think the goal is to do the cut arenas at some point over the next couple of years. You know, 2,500, 3,000 and change. But this time, you know, we're doing 1,000 caps and I bring full production. I mean, when you come see one of my shows, I mean, you're going to think that I'm a B-level American artist because I really do put the money in. So I think I roll with 10 people now.
Awesome. I think that's great, man.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. And man, these tunes are great. I can't wait to hear the rest of the record. And I've really enjoyed talking to you, man. You seem like a really, really good person. And
yeah, some days.
Well, who isn't? I hope the best for you, and I hope that the best for your family. And man, good luck. Good luck on the tour. People can go out and find you at it's Tebe Official, right? Hold on, let me see what this. Yeah, Tebe Official.
Is the website. Right? Yeah, and then Instagram, I think it's Tebe or Tebe Music. It's one of those two on Facebook and Instagram. So yeah, would love to have the followers.
Yeah, get out there and check out the music. And congratulations on all of your success. It really has been great talking to you, Tebe. Is there anything I'm missing that you want to say?
I appreciate you taking the time, man. This has been fun.
Of course, man. I love doing this. I love meeting people like you. Do you ever get down to Texas at all?
You know, last time I was in Texas, I flew to Houston for UFC. Oh, wow. I'm a massive UFC fan.
Nice.
Right. So I was down there for that. Well, I've got some friends that one of my buddies is from Canada, but he used to play for the Dallas Stars. So he's down there. He's coaching with Dallas now. So I may come down at some point. I'd like to get to Austin. I've heard good things about Austin.
That's where I live. It's a good place.
Oh, cool, yeah. Cool, cool. Yeah. Well, if I get down there, I'll holler at you, man, for sure.
Yeah, please do, dude. It was great meeting you, and I'll let you guys know when this drops. It'll be a few weeks.
But great, absolutely. Great, yeah, again, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man, great talking to you, KB.
Take care, man.
Bye, brother.
Tried to turn it down, but had to change the dial. Still hurts like hell every time I hear it.
That was KB. That's his song. Used to love that song. Get out there and check out all of his singles, Sync with the Sun. What Was I Drinking? And of course, Used to Love That Song. Go to TayBayOfficial.com for all of your Taybay needs. See the videos. See when he's coming to a town near you. Check it out, baby. Man, what a great guy, man. That was an inspiring story. What a cool, cool dude. I really, really enjoyed talking to him. And I hope you enjoy his music, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you're new to the show, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts. New shows all the time. This was episode 1,210. I put out 2 to 3 shows a week, no matter what. 52 weeks a year. Johnny Gowdy. Pumping them out on How Did I Get Here. You can find us on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, wherever it is you find podcasts. Subscribe. Like them, share them, follow us on How Did I Get Here on Facebook. You can follow me. I'm at Johnny Gowdy on Instagram and Twitter. Have a great, great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. Here's the rest of this song. Used to Love That Song by the great Taybay. All right, take it easy, y'all. Party down. Let's get down.
All the wind in your hair, air drumming on the dash. Every minute of the melody takes me back to how it used to be. It's only 3 chords and the truth is you're still. Girl, I used to love that song. When you're out on the town and the DJ puts it on, do you stop in your tracks? Does it make you think of me? Do you head through the door 'cause you know it'll get you? Order up another. Just let it hit you. Are you like me? Do you ever say to yourself, I used to love that song. We turned it up every time it came on. Those Pioneer speakers gave it all they had. Wind in your hair, air drumming on the dash. Every minute of the melody takes me back to how it used to be. It's only 3 chords and the truth is you're still. Turned it up every time it came on. Those Pioneer speakers gave it all they had. Wind in your hair, air drumming on the dance. Every minute of the melody takes me back to how it used to be. It's only 3 chords and the truth is you're still gone. Girl, I used to love that song. Girl, I used to love.